You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. Our guest today is Marine Corps Brigadier General Thomas Droughty, now retired. Tom, may I call you that?
Please.
All right. Tom attended the Naval Academy, graduated, and was commissioned in 1962. He had a lifelong desire, ambition as it were, to be a Marine, and he fulfilled that, and over the years served in a variety of command staff positions. In 1990, as a Brigadier General, he joined the 1st Marine Division as its assistant division commander, and while in that position, he was in charge of deception for the Marines involved in Operation Desert Storm. And that's what we wanted to talk about today, yes, because our focus will be, during Desert Storm, the deception operations that you, in effect, were in charge of. Incidentally, General Droughty retired from the Marine Corps in 1992, and he is and has been for some 8 years the CEO of the Marine Corps University Foundation in Quantico, Virginia. So, a number of our listeners that we hear from are in some cases new to intelligence, new to thinking about world affairs and the way that we do here. Could you give us a sense of Desert Storm? What was Desert Storm?
Surely. Desert Storm was an operation running from 17 January until 28 February of 1991, a coalition of 34 countries operating under a United Nations mandate to do two things, eject the Iraqis from Kuwait and restore the government in Kuwait. And preceding this, in August of 1990, the Iraqis had invaded Kuwait and taken over at that point. So in response to that, the first operation was Desert Shield, which is more of a defensive operation. And then the attack into Kuwait to restore the government and to eject the Iraqis was known as Desert Storm.
And just to add a little personal color to it, I remember when Iraq, Saddam Hussein took over Kuwait, there were screaming headlines. And the reports coming out of Kuwait were just horrible atrocities of murders and rapes, imprisonments and so forth being carried out by the Iraqi forces.
Yes.
And there was a sense of outrage around the world and a cry for somebody to do something. And yes, so it was not just a little minor sideshow in the Middle East. It really was the center of attention. And the question had been, would or would he not, that is Saddam Hussein, go into Kuwait? Well, the answer was he did. And that's what you were confronted with, being in the Marine Corps at that time, part of the American force.
We were in the further concern was, would he go into Saudi Arabia? And with that, not just the oil, but also the water.
Sure.
And so all of those factors then brought about, again, the first operation of Desert Shield, that is a defensive alignment,
yes,
if you will, that then was followed by Desert Storm, which was the offensive aspect of our operations.
Right. How did you, and you don't have to get into names, but how did you come to be placed in charge of the deception operation that was part and parcel of the Marines going into Kuwait?
Peter, this is a case of where when you think you have a good idea, you're oftentimes put in charge of it.
yeah.
I wrote a paper.
You think you're so smart. Huh?
But literally on a yellow line tablet about deception, some things that we should consider based upon my interest in it that has gone over a period of years. And I provided it to the division commander, General Mike Myatt, who then provided it to the commander of the Marine Forces, General Walt Boomer. And General Boomer said, okay, Droughty, you're in charge of deception. So, and I was blessed with that assignment in addition to being the assistant division commander of the 1st Marine Division.
Once you volunteered your thoughts and were actually then said, okay, these are some great ideas, you're in charge, what were your first steps? What did you do after you got that assignment?
I guess the first thing was say a prayer to make sure it would all work out as I had hoped. But the next was to gather together folks that would be useful in this endeavor. And I guess I was looking for individuals who, to use an old phrase, able to think outside the box, but not too far outside the box. One of the challenges from what I had read about deception is that if it appears to be hokey or so outlandish, then it not only becomes useless, it becomes counterproductive because the enemy then really knows you're up to something different from what you're portraying. So it was to surround myself with guys smarter than me, which was easy to do, and to then go over what it was that we had in mind to accomplish, what we would need in the way of assets, and then to go out to the various commanders to get their contribution, if you will, to the deception effort. And again, it's useful when it's a general officer making that request as opposed to a colonel or below, and it's simply because it's easy to say no to a peer, but kind of have to say no to it to a general. So, but in my case, I had the full support of both General Myatt and General Boomer, so it made it a lot easier.
Let me just ask you, General, did you have a background in deception? Is this something that had been a personal interest? Had you been trained or educated in the field? What prompted you to make that suggestion? What was your background in doing it?
More of interest and then a little bit of exposure, if you will. The interest really began in 1956 when I was 16 years old with the movie The Man Who Never Was, a true story of the alleged British Royal Marine major whose body, I guess, and a follow-on book to that is Operation Mincemeat. But anyway, I saw that movie as a youngster and said, gee, that's fascinating to think that they could bring about those results by use of deception. I guess furthered another book of Le Carre's book, Little Drummer Boy, and again, the use of deception and all the factors that go into that. I was an instructor at Fort Bragg between Vietnam tours and had a chance to attend some of the classes and I guess picked up from that as well. But I guess the main thing was I was a convert to maneuver warfare, which means operating a little bit smartly, use of deception, find a flank or make a flank, all of those things that would cause us to fight smarter. So long answer to your question, but interest and a little bit of experience.
And I know you served with great distinction in Vietnam. Had you had some experience of deception operations in Vietnam?
Very limited. The deception there would be so elementary of a helicopter landing zone going to one spot and then to another as if we were going to fool the Viet Cong and to where the actual landing would be, but nothing of any degree of formality or sophistication that we later had an opportunity to bring about.
Could you just talk to me a little bit about deception? Bring me up to speed as a layman and sort of when you use that term and you think about deception, what are you thinking about? Are there some principles? What are you drawing on as you approach what you're doing and what we did in Kuwait? But you're thinking in terms of deception. What's that about?
Deception for me was to convince my adversary that we were going to do something or think about doing something that would work to our interests should he believe that. The perfect deception is, and probably the best example was, again, The Man Who Never Was, of that we were actually going to attack Sicily but to have Hitler convinced that it was going to be Greek and Sardinia. It helps a great deal when the target of your deception has a preconceived notion of what you're going to do. And if you can then reinforce that, it helps a great deal. In the Pentagon, we had a saying that the only thing harder than driving in a new idea was driving out an old one. So if you know what your enemy wants to believe and can reinforce that, it makes it easier. It's also a matter of understanding what can be concealed, what should not be concealed, what is part of the overall plan, but again designed to accomplish the mission with the minimum risk of life and limb by using our intelligence in both the military sense as well as our intuitive intelligence to bring about the results based upon a plan, a picture, a scheme, a perception that is not true.
This, of course, the idea of deception goes back to Sun Tzu, the Chinese military strategist. If you can win the battle with never firing a shot, as it were.
In my class on deception, I go back to the Garden of Eden. So it really goes way back to deception.
Okay. The deception in the Garden of Eden being?
Well, the serpent
yes.
Telling Eve, you know, if you eat the apple, you'll...
Yes.
So we live with deception literally all of our lives.
A good example. Deception, and I'll just pick up on what you were talking about, Operation Mincemeat, which was the man who never was. And I think when we think of deception, we also think of doing a variety of things. What we're trying to do is paint a false picture in the adversary's mind. So it may consist of a number of things that we do.
Oh,
yes. Mincemeat being one thing, there were other things that were done. And I'm thinking that you were thinking in the same way. I've heard reference to Task Force Troy during this period. Was that part of the deception activities?
It was. Task Force Troy was a follow-on to my being assigned as a deception officer. Uh-huh. And I called together a small group and said, here's our task is to conduct deception operations. And one of the factors is, of course, having the resources to do that. In Desert Storm, or the lead-up to Desert Storm, the challenge we had was we were fighting outnumbered. And so for any of the units to give up any resources was going to be a struggle. And so one of the factors in a successful deception operation is to have the commander's support so that it's not a thing of, well, I've got to do this, so a minimal support of it, but rather full-fledged support in order to get the assets. So with Task Force Troy, which averaged about 120 Marines, we, among other things, replicated the 2nd Marine Division, which is over 15,000. By when the 2nd Marine Division was on our eastern or our right flank, and we wanted to reposition them over to the left of us, we wanted the Iraqis to believe that they were still in place. And so Task Force Troy was a part of that deception effort to replicate the 2nd Division. So as, for example, when their artillery and tanks would be pulling out, we would then put into place dummy tanks and artillery that had been constructed by the Seabees, so that for the purpose of the Iraqis looking at all of this, everything was the same. We would continue having helicopters that would stop at what was the old command post and as if making liaison visits. Meanwhile, the division was pulling around behind us and moving over to the western flank. Task Force Troy was also involved in things such as the use of noises as part of our deception. One day, an Army psychological operations officer came to me and said, I'm reporting to you, I have a number of assets. Asked what they were, included leaflets, which are useful, but you had to be careful that it states what you want the reader to understand, not what you think makes sense. He also said he had tapes, and I said, that's great. What do you have, a rock and roll, country western, golden? He said, no, not tapes of music, but tapes of noise. And I said, well, Captain, if you listen carefully, I've got all the noise here that I need. I don't need tapes of noise. I've got real noise. No, sir, this is noise made by weapon systems. And so the light went on, in my case as an infantryman, and said, do you happen to have tank noise? And he lightened up and said, sir, I've got M60 tank noise, which we have, and the M1A1 tank noise. Now, as a Marine, to have a choice of something, this is fantastic. So I said, all right, give me the tank noise for the M60 tank, and we're going to hook those up to loudspeakers, and at night run those loudspeakers with that tank noise opposite the Iraqi lines that we may be penetrating. And when we punched through that unit, our interpreter brought the logbook of that unit and said, General, you're not going to believe this. I said, try me. He said, the first night that we ran those tank noises, the enemy went ballistic. Tank attack, tank attack, full alert. You know, everybody locked and cocked and ready to go. Next night, tank noises again. After about 2 weeks, the notation is tank noises, ho-hum, or the Arabic equivalent of that. And then one night they heard tank noises and they weren't recordings. We were able to punch through because we lulled them into that sense of hearing tank noises. So it's a part of what Task Force Troy did, but I think it's an example of how with a minimum of assets, you can bring about some significant results, and that's what I think the message of deception is, to fight smart and to make use of the intelligence, the assets, the imagination, the ingenuity that are typically Americans. And as I said one time, we should be experts at deception. We've lived with it all of our lives. It's called advertising.
Yes. So, let me, if I may, just pick up on a couple of things quickly. When you talked about this handful of folks, 140, by the way, I assume Troy is not a misnomer, but it was deliberately selected,
by
you.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure who gets the credit for that.
But when you talked about replicating, what you were saying, in effect, was these 140 people would do things so that they would look like the unit you just named, which was the
2nd Marine Division.
The 2nd Marine Division would then
pull behind us to get over to the western flank of us.
Okay. What I wanted to come to two things. What was the fundamental deception that you were carrying out? In other words, aside from the business with the tanks, which is fascinating, but what was the big picture on the deception?
In that particular case, the deception was that the 2nd Division was where it had been, and therefore to the east of us, and therefore the punch that we would make would be from our current locations rather than from our position as the 1st Marine Division, and then also from a position to the west of us where the 2nd Division was. This led then to a double breach of the minefield, which allowed both divisions to get through quickly and then to move on into Kuwait, Kuwait City, and so forth.
What do you mean by double breach of the minefields?
That instead of a single breach of one division going through followed by another division, that the two divisions would breach side by side. And to do that, we needed the 2nd Division over to the west of us, which is the relocation, and therefore to deceive the enemy into thinking that 2nd Division was still to the east of us.
But when you say breach, what do you mean? What do you mean?
To actually get through the minefields, to be able to get the tanks, troops, equipment through without being victims of the mine.
So was that an operation performed with mine clears? In other words, were people lost? I'm trying to get the picture in my mind of breaching the minefield.
Oh, yes, a combination of material. Oftentimes it was Marines with bayonets going out and finding the mines, marking the lanes so that we could get through. And this is an area that we spent a lot of time in preparation for this, a great deal of it with the assistance of the Desert Rats, the British brigade that assisted us with an awful lot of things that were useful to us, such as mine clearance, being able to get across barriers, trenches, etc.
Clearly, your deception, the deception operation you decided on, was to prepare the ground virtually before you went in and force. Before you did that, before we went in and force, could you tell that your deceptions were taking hold, that they were working, that the adversary was reacting in the way that you wanted him to react?
I believe that we did because of the lack of movement or response on their part. They were still in place in the form of the divisions along the beach and the units opposite where the 2nd Marine Division had been. So as long as we were seeing no change in that disposition, we believed that they were still under the assumption that we were going to do what they presumed we were going to do. So that gave us a lot of confidence that that it was working, but always prepared that they were deceiving us in the process also. But we were fairly confident. And then the other was in the artillery raids that I had described of the response on the part of the Iraqis when fired upon. No longer were they automatically firing back. They were looking for ways to surrender. So I think that it helped also that in kind of working down our chipping away at their will to fight through various efforts, the PSYOPs, electronic warfare, et cetera, was having an effect on them. So and that was prior to our actually invading, and it gave us a better outlook than we had initially, again, with the being outnumbered, out-tanked, outgunned, all the rest of it.
One of the things that when you and I were talking earlier, I think you mentioned, this really was the first time that American forces, in this case the Marine Corps, came up against what was it the third largest or sixth largest army in the world, standing army. Isn't that, was it the sixth largest standing army?
Fourth or sixth, somewhere in there,
okay.
But I guess.
And with highly vaunted, at least by its own writers and so forth.
Yes.
But we really had not confronted them in battle. We had seen the whole confrontation between Iran and Iraq, which involved huge numbers of men being thrown into
yes.
tanks and so forth. Did you, in the course of carrying this out, reformulate what the Iraqi fighting man was like?
We did, partly based upon the Battle of Kafchi. Now, the Battle of Kafchi was with the Saudi Arabian National Guard, which we supported, but they were the main components in retaking the city of Kafchi. But we noticed that the Iraqis could fire or maneuver, but not both. And, of course, success in combat means that you can fire and maneuver. Also, the reputation of being 10 feet tall kind of changed because of their performance there. So we had a greater feeling of confidence, certainly not overconfidence, but on our part of being able to punch through the minefields and to get into Kuwait quickly and secure Kuwait City and the rest of our objectives. So that was, I think, part of our reevaluation. And that was, we had, the other was to condition the Iraqis into responding to fire. We wanted the Iraqis to believe that any time that they fired on an American, that the consequences were going to be uncomfortable. And so we would use whatever we could in that regard, things like artillery raids that I mentioned to you. We were able to bring in the battleship and a 16-inch round certainly gains your attention. So all of those factors that, in fact, in one case, Iraqi units were surrendering to drones that were overhead, thinking that this was some kind of a thing. And other occasions where a single round would take place and tank crews would evacuate the tank immediately. So that psychological preparation, if you will, it was also effective.
Well, I think you you touched on that earlier. Namely, that once you carried out this deception, you actually had encircled a bunch of Iraqis who simply surrendered in droves. I mean, you had trouble transporting them to get them out of the area of the fighting.
We did. One of the major factors there, Peter, was the amphibious assault and the belief that was going to take place. We had reporters with our units. We didn't call them embedded reporters, but our feeling, again, General Boomer had been Director of Public Affairs, as I was after this assignment, believed that the American media is the eyes and ears of the American people, and therefore they should see the things within reason, of course, that are taking place. We would never lie to the press. That's the mortal sin that we would not commit, but allow the press to see what was taking place. Well, part of the press was aboard ship watching the amphibious rehearsals, the preparations, and so forth. And, of course, being televised, and one of the viewers was a guy named Saddam Hussein, who came to the conclusion that there was going to be an amphibious assault. And so we certainly reinforced that belief by rehearsals, et cetera. And he then put into place on the coast somewhere between 5 to 7 divisions that were tied down that we did not have to fight because they were there to thwart an amphibious assault that, of course, did not take place. So we then just circled behind them and were able to capture them all with minimum fire or risk to a life and limb on either side.
Was the fundamental, the idea for a deception of this magnitude carried out the way you've described, was that the creation of one man or I'm thinking back to the Incheon landing and that sort of thing, yeah. Where I think that was MacArthur's own idea, was it not?
The riskiness added to the brilliance and the success of it. In this case, I think it was a matter of factors, not the least of which that to do an amphibious assault at that part of Kuwait would have been extremely difficult. Challenges, mines, limited landing sites, all of those things would have made an amphibious assault most, most difficult. And so with that came the decision to not do an assault, but to continue on with the illusion that we were going to be doing the assault. And again, never lying to the press, was simply allowing them to see what we were doing and letting Saddam Hussein come to his conclusions, which were we were definitely going to do assault. And I guess part of the reputation, if you have Marines, there's going to be an amphibious assault, perhaps led further to that conclusion. But it was a success in that regard of tying down enemy divisions that we did not have to fight.
I'm intrigued by the way you put that. No, you were very straightforward with the press, but you happened to be doing something that, in effect, you knew this wasn't what you were going to do. So, but let those think what they will. It's clear from the way you describe it that you knew what you couldn't do. In other words, the intelligence about the landing area, about what we knew about the Iraqis, where they were deployed and so forth, was critical to your then formulating the deception plan.
Oh, yes. And further in the deception, in the class that I teach, I focus on the requirement for intelligence, one of which is determining whom you must deceive. Who's the individual who will make the decision that will either result in success or failure of your plan? And then the next step is knowing who that individual is, knowing everything you can about that person, level of education, background, experience, all of those factors, so that the message that is sent is not going to be over the head, but not so elementary that it would cause, you know, a concern or questioning, what is this all about? It's got to be kind of the Goldilocks message of just right. But that only happens when you have good intelligence of knowing who the decision maker is, whom you must deceive. And then further with intelligence, what is happening? Is there a response? Is it the response that you want? Of course, in World War II, it was made a lot easier with Ultra that you could read the message traffic. But in our case, just watching what takes place. I would tell our folks, put yourself in the position of the enemy who's looking at our deception operations. And we use a term called the salute report. And it's simply the size, activity, location, unit, time, and equipment. What are those things that enemy would be reporting on in our deception operation that would lead them to believe that we are going to do what the deception plan would be? And then you accommodate accordingly. The size, again, it has to be a size that you're capable of putting on the field. If you don't have an armored division, you're not going to fool anybody by indicating you've got an armored division. What kind of activity goes with it? Is it digging in? Is it preparation for an assault? All of those things, again, part of the deception plan, but seen through the eyes of the enemy, the one that you want to deceive.
Well, it's quite clear from the results that the deception was a grand success. And I know that there's other researchers have gone in and sort of verified what the Iraqis thought they were seeing. And quite clearly, they were seeing what you wanted them to see. I'm just wondering, you touched on one thing there, which sort of we both look back at World War II. By the way, may I use that Goldilocks message? I think
sure.
That's a great phrase, and I had never heard of it.
It was something, just right.
Just right, okay.
Just right.
But the idea of communications have changed so rapidly, even since Desert Storm. And so either if we are confronting an adversary in the future, and it looks like our future is going to hold something along those lines from time to time, or an adversary coming at us. To what extent has the rapid, the not just the internet, but tweets and the, this ability, the cyber warfare aspect of confrontation, to what extent has that affected the ability to do something like what you did?
I think, Peter, that it presents, this will sound strange, but a golden opportunity. At a conference, I was asked that question, how can you deceive now with all of the things that are available? And my response is, because it provides greater assets in the way of the countermeasures to that. So, and every measure has a countermeasure. And I think if, as long as we look at it in that context of it's not all over because now we have rapid communications, texting, tweeting, and all the rest of it, that provides more opportunities to send the message that we want to reinforce the deception plan. The other part is that sometimes the deception is not going to be kind of a black and white, full success, full failure. It's going to be somewhere in between. But even that in between is useful. First of all, as I tell my students, I've checked the law of land warfare. It is not a war crime to fool the enemy. Okay, but oftentimes fooling the enemy is simply creating uncertainty. What are you really going to do? And by creating that uncertainty, it adds to the likelihood of our success as opposed to his certainty that we're going to do A or B, but maybe it's an A minus or a B plus. It's somewhere in between. So it's not a full-fledged deception victory with everything accomplished and so forth. If it's enough to confuse the enemy, to cause them to ask, what are they really up to? Then it's worth the effort.
Just two final things. One, it was interesting to hear you describe how you came to head up the deception effort. Do you think we have, in many ways, become more sophisticated about deception in the American military? We've had so many opportunities that were in the last number of years to engage in conflict, whether it's Korea or Vietnam or now these activities in Iraq and so forth. It sounded almost, when you described your efforts, as if you went in waving a book and said, oh, I think we could do this, and someone said, okay, you're in charge. Yeah. Do you think it's become more of an accepted part of our operations, our military operations?
I hope so, Peter. Of course, so much of this is going to be classified, and I'm not going to have access to that, but I would hope that those things that we have learned in many cases the hard way will not be lost, and that folks who can see the results of deception and how in the planning stages as you're reviewing courses of action that you always hold one out that is not selected as a possible deception plan that could then provide the basis then for causing the enemy to wonder what are you really going to do, but that could be executed if necessary. And I'm just not sure. I can only hope that through the efforts of a number of graybeards like me that can say, you know, deception really works, and it doesn't require a lot of assets. It just requires imagination, ingenuity, some smart folks, smarter than we are individually, but collectively can be very, very useful. I hope that that tremendous capability that we as Americans have would not be lost.
Well, hearing the results and knowing, by the way, that this podcast will be listened to by any number of people, I hope your words go forth. I hope a number of people listen to them. And I'd like to end, and I think in all fairness, you've been kind enough to join us today and offer us these remarks on Desert Storm. Could you say something about the Marine Corps University Foundation?
Which, oh, I'd love to.
Well, and I think in all fairness, we'd like to invite you to.
I think this is known as a shameless plug, but I'll seize it. Yes, the Marine Corps University Foundation provides resources to enhance and enrich professional military education and leadership. So that's our niche, so to speak, primarily for the Marine Corps University, which is at Quantico in the form of the Marine Corps War College, School of Advanced Warfighting, Command and Staff College, the Expeditionary Warfare School, but also the six Staff and SEAL academies located throughout the world. So we're involved in professional military education of not just officers, also enlisted, and not just Americans, also international officers, and not just military, but other government agencies as well. We also support the operating forces and supporting establishment. So those units that more and more find themselves with a limited budget, but a requirement or a desire to do something beyond what they're capable of doing, what we call the margin of excellence, we attempt to provide the wherewithal to close that gap. So things like battlefield studies and support of the units on guest speakers and so forth to enhance and enrich, again, their professional military education. So we have a saying that we change lives and save lives because we believe that professional military education is what will bring home more and more of our youngsters because they've been better educated, better prepared for the uncertainties of combat.
Well, I'm going to invite you, if you'd like to provide an email or something. So anybody listening to this, if they want to contact you directly and ask more about it, they can.
Sure. That's www.mcuf.org.
Okay. How do you spell that again?
MCUF for Marine Corps University Foundation.org.
Okay. Yes, well, General Tom Droughty, it has been a pleasure talking to you. It's interesting to hear another side of Desert Storm put so succinctly. I hope that you continue to head up that foundation and that the teachings you touched on today endure. Thank you so much again.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you so much.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum, that's one word, .org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you.